Well, as always, it's very good to see you. It's wonderful if we have any visitors here this evening also. As was offered this morning, if you have curiosity about Monte Vista and the gospel that we preach, we do believe it is God's gospel, his good news to the world, that all people can be saved through belief and obedience to the words of Jesus Christ. And if you're curious about that message, then please let us know. We'd love to sit down and have a Bible study with you on those things. Now, in our interaction with the world, we encounter some rather difficult questions about faith and about morality, about choices that people make and what to do in this or that ethical situation. And it has often been speculated, not just by Christians, but unbelievers alike, just what good religion does for people. I read an article recently, and the title of which was, "It's Official, Religion Doesn't Make You More Moral." And you know, I had to read it. That's the sort of thing where you, when you read that, you just go, okay, all right, hook, line, sinker, you got me. Show me the article. I'm going to read you a couple things out of this article here. Suppose you actually do have an angel that's over your shoulder telling you the right thing to do all the time. That angel probably wouldn't tell you anything you didn't already know. A recent study in Science magazine aimed at uncovering how we experience morality in our everyday lives suggests that religious people are no more moral or immoral than non-religious people. Whether or not we believe that divine precepts give us guidance, our behavior, the writer says, is remarkably similar. Now, how this research was conducted is rather dubious, but I'm going to give you an explanation from the writer's own words of how they went about discovering just why it is that religion does not make us more moral or immoral than the unbelievers around us. He goes on to say, the current study breaks new ground in a few different ways. They always like studies that break new ground, don't they? It's always a buzzword there. Perhaps most importantly, previous psychological studies of moral responses relied on observations in laboratory settings. How shocking! This study, however, uses a method that allows researchers to escape the lab and catch glimpses of how participants think about morality as they go about their daily lives. Researchers using the method known as ecological momentary assessment periodically contact participants to report their feelings. You're going, that doesn't really sound like the scientific method very much, does it? In this study, over 1,200 people were texted, the most scientific method of gathering information. See, here I am. I'm committing a philosophical fallacy here by discrediting minor aspects of the research. In this study, over 1,200 people were texted 5 times a day over the course of 3 days. The texts asked if they'd committed, experienced, or heard moral or immoral acts in the previous hour. If a participant answered yes, there were follow-up questions that prompted him or her to describe the event and some of his or her reactions to it. And notice again, the events included things that you heard about, observed in other people, or committed yourself. Any moral or immoral action that happened around you that you observed was to be reported on. The researchers collected over 13,000 responses, almost 4,000 of which described a moral or immoral event. The acts ranged from the mundane to the unexpected. Assisted a tourist with directions because he looked lost. At work, someone stole my partner's nice balsamic vinegar while he was off shift and most likely took it home with them. Another one was hired someone to kill a muskrat that's ultimately not causing any harm. The first thing that I want to notice about this study before we come to the conclusion that they came to is this. Be very, very wary of grabby headlines. You know, I'm not saying don't click on the article and read what it has to say, because I'm sorry. Sometimes you read something and you just are like, okay, you got me. I want to see what you're talking about. But be very, very careful of grabby headlines, because they more often than not are presenting either incomplete or outright false preconceptions about a subject. They're trying to build a preconception in your mind without providing you all of the information. Now, you know how the test went. Okay, I just explained it to you. And you know what the results were. Religious people and non-religious people seem to interpret moral and immoral events on about the same rate and basis as each other. So being religious doesn't make you more moral. So you know the outcome. And yet this title, it's official. Religion does not make you more moral. Is that really the point of the research, first of all? Second of all, is that really a complete explanation of what the research concluded? I don't know. I'm always really careful of stuff like this because it's really easy in our culture of sound bites and text messages and little Twitter responses all over the place. It's very easy for us to accept the highly truncated and encapsulated pieces of information that we come across all the time and accept them as just plain and simple truth. We accept things like that because that's how we think. I see a short message that confirms what I either already believe or what I want to believe, and I'm going to accept that short message without any further research whatsoever. You remember the headline, God is dead? Right? Come on. Does that give the complete story? Does that really give the complete story? God is dead. No, but it's grabby. And it'll get you to buy the magazine, won't it? Yeah, because that's how we think. Yeah, I already don't believe that religion makes you more moral than any non-religious person. And this article proves it because it's got it right in the title. And we get excited about stuff like that. We eat it up in our culture. We just eat it up. But the thing about it is, honesty requires more research than that, than just broad and sweeping generalizations. And of course, the researchers admit that the test is full of potential inaccuracies. Even in the article, they go on to say, there's reason to be cautious about the results. Like, yeah. The study relies on the participants in the study to self-report honestly and accurately, and participants might be embarrassed to reveal moral or immoral acts. People also have a tendency to overestimate how moral they've been. Because in our own self-assessment, we always believe we're better than we actually are. We find ways of justifying our actions. But we also find ways of kind of inflating the actions that we've committed. We might go and we do something that doesn't require a lot from us. We pat ourselves on the back and say, well, I really made a difference today. But we love that kind of stuff, don't we? We love the kind of charity that costs nothing. We love good deeds that require very little energy. We love doing good things that require very little time from us. And when we're able to put the bare minimum effort into doing a good deed, we pat ourselves on the back and say, I changed the world today. Our self-estimation of morality or immorality is incredibly inaccurate if there is not an objective standard by which we measure such actions. So, does religion make us more or less moral than the people around us? The thing about it is, when you allow any and every definition of morality into the equation, you have essentially nullified any results that you've gotten. The researchers even went out of their way to point out that we did not give any definitions to morality or immorality. We simply said, report to us immoral or moral actions that you observe or commit yourself in that given hour. They didn't tell them what morality was or what immorality was. They gave no definition, no guidelines whatsoever. Which to me, that just kind of nullifies the whole thing. I mean, that'd be like asking somebody like, you know, what sport do you think is good? What sport do you think is best? Or football, right? College football. Which team deserves to be ranked higher? It's not Ohio State. I'm telling you, Tom. I'm telling you, man. Just kidding. It's Oregon. Everybody knows that. These are all completely subjective things. And so when you're talking about morality versus immorality without giving some kind of guideline or definition, what have you actually proven? You know, all you've proven, and this is, I think, a strong point. All you've proven is that people tend to have a set of guidelines by which they live. And that all people, regardless of what the guidelines are, tend to see about the same amount of moral or immoral actions based on their guidelines. The same action can be viewed quite differently depending on the guidelines that you choose. Consider, for example, if you were taking this test, if you were doing this research, participating in it, and your definition of morality was environmental sustainability and responsibility, that was your big thing, is all of morality is based on living in Mother Earth in a respectful way, then if you saw somebody recycle a soda can, you'd text and say, "I just saw a moral action. Somebody was moral. They recycled a soda can. I saw a guy driving a Prius. He just did a moral thing because he drove a Prius. And I just saw Jason Amelong buy a giant Dooley pickup truck. I witnessed an immoral action." If that was your definition of morality, if that was the foundation upon which you built your moral guidelines, then sure, I can understand it. Let's say your definition of morality starts with respecting authority. I think all morality begins with authority. And I saw somebody pull over to let a police car with his lights go past to whatever scene of the crime he was getting. That's a moral thing, because that person respected the laws and respected the authority of that police officer driving down the road with his lights on. That would be a moral thing, right? If my definition of morality was based on respecting authority. So you see the problem here. As long as everybody's definition of morality and immorality is taken into account, we have not come to a real conclusion. What is moral? Some of the things that you and I might consider very moral or immoral might be interpreted quite differently to somebody else. What if in this research you observed a coworker taking a buddy out for a beer after work because he had a bad day? Now, to an unbeliever, to the drinker, that would be seen as a moral thing, right? What a nice thing. That's a great thing. Boy, he took his friend out, he took his buddy out for a beer after a hard day of work. That's a moral thing that I just saw. To the Christian, we might not view that as something that's quite so moral, because you took your friend out so that he could avoid rather than deal with his problems, and you got him intoxicated. I don't think we would interpret that to be a moral action. How about embracing homosexual marriage? One person might see a gay couple going into the courthouse to get married and say, "Look at that, two people in love, sanctifying their relationship in a legal marital arrangement. That's a moral action." We would not take that action to be the same thing necessarily. How about helping somebody get revenge on an ex-girlfriend or something? Like, "Man, I was there for you. I had your back. Boy, we really got it, didn't we? Best friends forever." But the Christian would go, "Well, wait, Romans chapter 12 says never take your own revenge on anybody." We would not see that as a moral act. How about aborting a fetus with Down syndrome? What if you asked Richard Dawkins, who's basically the Pat Robertson of atheists? If you asked Richard Dawkins, in his own words, it is more moral to abort a fetus that is shown by testing to have Down syndrome than it would be to let that child be born and live his life. Because according to Richard Dawkins' own definition of morality, morality is the reduction of suffering in this world. If your action results in less suffering, then it's moral. If your action results in increased suffering, it is immoral. That's his definition of morality. He's a pragmatist, after all. Whatever works best is what you got to go with. And he does believe, in his own words, that it's moral to abort a fetus if you know by testing that fetus is going to have Down syndrome. So what is moral? We've got to have some kind of consistent definition, don't we? This study is completely preposterous because it attempts to give a statistical analysis without a consistent definition. This, after all, is one of the great debates. Where does morality come from? If morality doesn't come from God, then I want to know where. That's what I want to know. Where does it come from if not from God? What makes your definition or my definition or anybody's definition more valid than anybody else's definition? Does morality just come from pragmatism? Again, with whatever works, that's what's the right thing to do. If it works best, then that is what is more moral. Is that where it comes from? How about tradition? Oh, it's just moral because it's always been that way. Because people have always said it was moral, and we've always accepted that. Is that why murder is immoral? Because by tradition, we've just always accepted that murder is immoral? Is that why rape is immoral? Because by tradition, we've just accepted that rape is immoral, and that's how it's always been, and there's no other reason beyond that? Or what about evolution? How does evolution explain the development of morality in human culture? It can't. And if it cannot provide a definition, then morality is what? Some kind of vestigial trait from a more superstitious time? If it's not from God, then where does morality come from? All of these other explanations are totally and completely unsatisfactory in helping us explain morality. And here's the real problem. And it's up here on the screen. Here's the real problem. You have people who are essentially not good trying to define good. And I'll give you an analogy here. It's like the guy who's been divorced 5 times trying to tell you how to have a happy marriage. All right? It's like the college student with no field experience trying to tell you how the real world works. It's like the guy with $1 million of debt trying to tell you how to manage your money. When you have human beings who are essentially not good trying to define good, of course you're going to get all kinds of crazy, ridiculous definitions of good that are all at odds with each other, that don't fit with each other, that are even, in a lot of cases, contradictory with each other. Of course you're going to have a problem defining morality if every not good human being gets to have his own definition of good. Go to Romans. You'll notice in Romans chapter 3, this very point is brought out by the writer of Romans. As he quotes from the Psalms here in Romans chapter 3, quoting from Psalm 14 and Psalm 53, Romans chapter 3, verse 10, "There is none righteous, not even one. There's none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they've become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths, and the path of peace they have not known. There's no fear of God before their eyes." Now, he's not saying that every single one of us has the poison of asps under our lips. He's not saying that every single one of us is going to commit murder. He's not saying that every single one of us has committed the same crimes outlined here in this particular psalm. What he's saying, though, is that when you look at mankind, you do not find goodness in mankind apart from God. Take God out of the picture, and there is nobody who's good, because where does our goodness come from? It's not self-derived goodness. I'm not good because I'm good by myself. No, take God out of the picture, and he's absolutely right. There is nobody good. They don't seek after God. They do what they want. They follow the impulses of their heart. Remember we read earlier today in the Gospel of John where Jesus himself is talking about darkness and light and good. And even when he said, you know why people live in the darkness? Because they love the darkness. Their deeds are evil because they love the evil. They love to live in the darkness. That is where they are. Remember in Matthew chapter 16. In the story of the rich young ruler here, as Jesus is interacting with this rather interesting individual, in Romans chapter 16, Matthew chapter 19, beginning in verse 16, "And behold, one came to him and said, 'Teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may obtain eternal life?'" And I love Jesus' response in verse 17. "Why are you asking me about what is good? There is only one who is good. But if you wish to enter life, you must keep the commandments. And he said, well, which ones? And Jesus said, you shall not commit murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And you know what? Honestly, for most people in most cultures, that's a fairly acceptable list of things that are good. But the young man said to him, all these things I have kept, what am I still lacking? I love it how this young man, even though he was living a technically good life, still recognized that there was something missing from him. There was an element of goodness that he did not have, even with all of his righteous deeds that he had already done. And of course, we know the response that Jesus offers. He says, you've got to cut ties with the material possessions. Sell all that you have, give it to the poor, and come follow after me. The man could not do that. The man could not do that. Why are you asking me about what is good? Don't you know that there's only one who's good? And that's God. Go to the book of Psalms and notice in Psalm 82. In Psalm 82, beginning in verse 1, God takes his stand in his own congregation, the psalmist says. He judges in the midst of the rulers. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? That's mankind's definition of morality right there. Vindicate the weak and the fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them out of the hand of the wicked. Verse 5. They do not know, nor do they understand. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods. You are the sons of the Most High. Nevertheless, you will die like men and fall like any one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for it is thou who dost possess all the nations. And I love in particular verse 5. You don't know, you don't understand, you walk in darkness. So again, the problem I see here with any kind of research that sets about to find out morality and immorality and its relationship to religion without providing God's definition of what is right and wrong is going to fail. You're walking in darkness. You don't get it. You don't understand. There are some questions in this study that can't be answered, though. When they come quite confidently to the conclusion that religion does not make you more moral, I wonder, did they talk to everybody whose lives had been changed by religion? I don't know what basis this whole thing is being judged on, quite frankly. Because I know a lot of religious people who were made very much more moral by religion. And there are people who we find in the Bible who were changed a great deal by religion. As long as that religion is Christ's. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17. You tell me, did religion make the Ephesians more moral? This I say, therefore, and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer just as the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their hearts. And they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. But he says in verse 20, you did not learn Christ in this way. If indeed you've heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness and truth. Sometimes you just have nothing to say. Did religion make them more moral? What did religion do for these people? Did religion change them at all? Did you ask anybody whose life was changed by religion? Did you ask anybody whose life was ruined because of sin? Did you ask anybody whose physical person was destroyed, literally, physically, ruined because of a habit, because of an addiction, because of something they had in their life before they knew Jesus Christ? Relationships that were shattered and restored because of the power of God in reconciliation. Guilt that could never be dealt with and expunged until Jesus came along and cleaned that guilt from our souls. And now we live a life that's guilt-free. Did you ask all of those religious people if religion made a difference to them? Those are questions that were not asked in this research. Though I would counter with this. Is morality even the main point of Christianity? Well, now we're going far beyond the realm of this study, and that's okay. Because grabby headlines and dubious research is not what the Christian is really interested in. We are interested in more substance than that. We're interested in something that goes deeper. Something that we can really live in. Something that we can really abide by. And you can't find that in the world's mess. Is morality even the main point of Christianity? Consider, God's main concern in the gospel is not making us more moral through religious adherence. That's not his main goal. Now, does he want morality? Does he expect morality? Does he even command morality of us by his definition? Of course. But is that the main point of the gospel? Is Christianity all about making us more moral people? Actually, I think God's main point is not making us more moral, but in helping to define just how immoral we are. The law is not there to teach us how to be more moral. The law is there to give God some guidelines, some basis for establishing just how inadequate we are before His eyes. Romans chapter 7 and verse 7. Notice what Paul's argument here is in Romans chapter 7. And I love the way he puts it here when he's speaking here of covetousness in this particular context. In Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 7, he says, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Well, may it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin," in verse 8, "taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from me, apart from the law, sin is dead." Now he says in verse 9, "I was once alive apart from the law. But when the commandment came, sin became alive and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me." So the command, "Thou shalt not covet," did it really change anything? No, because coveting was still happening. That's something we need to remember. Before the Ten Commandments came along and said, "Thou shalt not covet," were people still coveting? Yeah. That the coveting was still happening. But God came along and defined coveting. He defined coveting. And when the definition of coveting came, did it make the coveting stop for everybody necessarily? No. Actually, Paul says, boy, when that command that says, "Thou shalt not covet," came, it actually produced in me death of all kinds. I was coveting all over the place. God coming in and just saying, "Thou shalt not covet," does not magically make people stop coveting. It doesn't magically make people stop coveting. But you know what that command does? Like it says here on the screen, it does help establish a basis for God's judgment of our inadequacy as we stand before Him. It is not about making us more moral, because morality, in a sense, doesn't help us a whole lot. Doesn't help us a whole lot. At least in the terms of self-derived goodness. Romans chapter 8. Notice what he says here in Romans 8, beginning in verse 1. "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death. For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and as an offering for sin, He condemned sin in the flesh, in order that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us, who do not walk according to the flesh, but who walk according to the Spirit." Self-derived goodness and adherence to the law, meritorious deeds, are incapable of saving us. I mean, I don't know how much more clear Paul can be when he says, "For what the law could not do, weak as it was." What could the law not do? It couldn't save you. So sure, keep every single one of the Ten Commandments. You ought to, at least in the sense that those Ten Commandments have morals that are behind them that still apply today. So sure, keep every ordinance of the law. Obey every little tiny ordinance from Exodus and Leviticus and obey everything. Memorize the book of Deuteronomy. Sure, adherence to the law. But what the law could not do, weak as it was, Jesus did. Jesus did. With all that being said, is moral action still necessary and required of us? Of course it is. In Revelation 21, verse 8, it specifically says that immoral persons have their place in the lake of fire that burns for all eternity. Ooh. So, don't tell me that morality is not required of us. Because the immoral person, the not moral person, has his place in the lake of fire. But here's something, an analogy that I think really helps us here. How can something be necessary and required without necessarily being part of the function? How can morality be required of us without saving us? And I thought of a good analogy for you. Driver's insurance. Auto insurance. Is auto insurance absolutely necessary here in Arizona to drive a car? Yeah. Everybody knows that. Even Emma nodded her head and said yes. She doesn't even drive. Yes. You absolutely must have auto insurance to legally drive a car here in Arizona. But does auto insurance help you drive at all? No. Does auto insurance steer the car for you? Does auto insurance press the gas pedal or the brake pedal? Does auto insurance change the oil in your car or other forms of maintenance on it? Does auto insurance pay your car payment for you? No. In a sense, automobile insurance has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual function of driving a car. It does not drive the car for you, and it does not help you drive the car. It has nothing to do with the function of driving a car. Yet it is still absolutely necessary to drive the car. So yeah, morality is required of us of God. We are required, commanded by God, to abstain from sinful behavior, to abstain from the things of the flesh, to abstain from materialism, to put our treasures in heaven, not here on the earth. We are commanded by God to do certain things that are moral and to abstain from things that are immoral. But just like auto insurance can't drive a car for you, all of the moral requirements that are placed on us by God cannot save us. They cannot save us. So the question really should not be, are religious people more moral than their non-religious counterparts? The question should be this: will my morality save me? So I'll tell you what, one of the biggest differences between Christians and people who are not Christians, one of the biggest differences, one of those groups is saved and the other one's not. So sure, show me research all day long that shows that religious people see moral things and immoral things and non-religious people see moral things and immoral things. It doesn't matter. I don't care. I don't care. Because if I'm not saved, I don't care how moral I am. I don't care what definition of morality I use. And I don't care how much morality I see around me. If I'm not saved, then morality did nothing. And that's the definition we need to look for. It's not, am I more moral? It's, am I saved? Now, if you're not a Christian here this evening, you need to be saved. You need to be saved. Now, you need to change your life and live right. Live according to what God has commanded of you. But first and foremost, you need to embrace the salvation that is freely offered to you through Jesus Christ. Mark 16, verse 16 says it best, and I'll end with this. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever needs you might have, I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.